Welcome. The reason we're using mics, I guess I'll keep it a little more away from my voice, is that everything's being taped. So we need to use the mic when we're speaking. My name is Rebecca Tollison, Executive Director of the Ohio Council of Churches. I have the privilege still of serving as the chair for the Local Planning Committee for this event. And the Local Planning Committee is responsible for two seminars to give you a sense of what's happening locally here in Ohio. And so I have had the privilege of knowing some of these people for over a year. And I think what we'll do is I want them to introduce themselves. Maybe just for me to say the first two young ladies here, the Ohio Council of Churches helped them to get to Interfaith Youth Core Training, which is the main office is in Chicago. Ibu Patel is the director of that, and they will tell you of how that was helpful or not helpful in their lives. Balpreet, I'd like you to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Balpreet, and I'm a president of the Six Student Association on campus, as well as the secretary for Better Together, which was the result of our training in Interfaith Youth Corps, and now we have an interfaith organization on campus.
Hi, my name is Carmen. I am vice president of Better Together, and I'm also secretary of an unrelated group called Unplugging Society, a women of color think tank. And it was actually through collaboration with Unplugging Society and the Hillel Center on campus that we started to have community dialogues on different issues that kind of breach different faiths. So from that, we kind of sought out to go to the IFYC conference, and which for me was great. You really saw that sense of community through different faiths, and knowing that that at least we weren't alone on the huge OSU campus with wanting to have more interfaith dialogue.
Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm my third year at Ohio State. I'm a student leader with Asian American and Diversity Christian Fellowship. I guess kind of my interest in this topic as a student, I am a comparative studies major, so I deal a lot with different topics of race and religion and identity, and also I'm very involved with the Asian American, specifically the South Asian Indian student population in Ohio State, so I think a lot about like topics of religion and how we express that.
Good afternoon. I'm Rebecca Nelson. I've been at Ohio State for 22 plus years, and part of my current responsibility is I convene our bias assessment and response team. And I think that's why Rebecca asked me to come to a conversation, because I see the cases that come forward where students are offended by things that occur in the public spaces on our campus. I've been involved as a student, and I'm very proud to say I know all of these individuals. And I currently serve as advisor to the Better Together student organization.
I just also want to introduce two others who have been in the conversation as we've worked over the past several months. Father Joe Ciccone, who is at the Newman Center. Dr. Taranjit Bhutalia, who is a professor at OSU. He's also the secretary for the World Sikh Foundation, is Sikh Council. So he's involved in many interreligious events around the country. So we have been a part of this conversation trying to figure out how to assess our own better understanding as religious leaders, but also from the students' perspective. So, Rebecca, you want to say, get us started with the case study and from there?
Sure. I gave you all a little cheat sheet. When I do these talks, I get a lot of questions, particularly from students, why can't the university do more? So I always like to start with a little refresher about the First Amendment. And the First Amendment has a broad stroke, particularly in higher education, where the campus is expected to be a marketplace of ideas, even if it's an exchange of an idea that you find offensive, right? So the case study is on the back side of the sheet, but what I've given you is some pieces that specifically apply to public forums, because that's what we're talking about. If you work with a campus, you may have what's called the campus mall. At OSU, it's called the Oval, right? But it's a place that's designated as a public space, and that's sort of the structure for our conversation this afternoon. And if you're a public institution, like Ohio State is, you even more have to be careful about any sense of prohibiting or impinging on people's freedom of speech in public spaces, all right? So on the first side of this sheet, I've identified some of the First Amendment issues, and this is from a book. I brought the book in case you wanted to see it. The First Amendment on Campus. All right. I've referenced this book many times over the years. It was in 2006, so there could be something that's more current, but it's still my go-to book for looking. And there's a variety of questions. So if you are working with a campus ministry or with university staff and other things, these are the questions that an administrator might go through to determine if something needs a First Amendment review. All right. So that's that first set of questions, which is just identifying First Amendment issues. Okay. And you'll notice that the second bullet is, does the issue at hand have any religious components? All right. Because state law tends to trump what could be a city ruling or a campus ruling, right? And so anything that involves any religious expression probably needs to have a First Amendment review, all right? There are exceptions to the First Amendment, however, and that's under item 2. However, the burden of evidence for why you would restrict expression has to be very high. Right. So while these are listed, the burden of evidence is very high. So defamation, obscenity, the one that a campus can probably most typically intervene is disruption of the academic environment. Somebody's on the bullhorn and it's so loud that a class can't hear the professor. Those sorts of things, right? True threat of violence, behavior that could produce an imminent lawless action, fighting words, invasion of privacy, and sexual or racial or other discriminatory harassment as ruled by law. And hate speech is not. That's very important. Hate speech, and it's a very tough thing for students to understand, but there is no definition, you know, of hate speech that's governed like we have for ADA rules for sexual harassment. Those things have specific laws attached to them, right? The third piece that I have under that I thought would be helpful for our conversation today is a forum analysis around the First Amendment. And how many of you work with public institutions? A couple of hands. Well, Joe, I know you do. Yeah, Father Joe.
Not really.
Yeah. There are differences between public and private. The venue in which we study and work in is a public institution, right? Private institutions have more leeway in saying what could happen unless the space has been designated as a public space by university or college policy, okay? But the traditional public forums would be things like public sidewalks, streets and parks. Many of us know that campuses have those things, right, in their land. And designated public forums, and that's the case at Ohio State. The Oval is designated as a public forum, all right? Sure. Now, what's really important is the strict scrutiny standard. So if, for example, in the last few years, I've received numerous reports from students very upset at campus preachers who they feel are preaching hate, and that's how they reported it, that they're preaching hate. But for the university to go in and remove people from a public forum would be unprecedented, right? It would be very difficult to justify. And that means that the institution would have to provide a compelling interest in limiting the expression or the words, and the limitation imposed must be narrowly tailored to achieve that goal. So that means you'd have to be making all of these arguments specific to that person and the things they're saying, which on a campus the size of Ohio State, you'd be doing that 5 to 10 times a day, right? So typically, there's a hands-off policy in the public forums unless somebody is touching somebody, getting in the way, like standing in their way as they're trying to get to class. But most of these speakers are very well versed in First Amendment rights. They go up to the ledge, but they don't go over it. They're very well versed in what their rights are.
Okay. And the if there is a
if there is a concern about public safety or impeding the academic mission of the institution, somebody could be asked to be moved to another section, like if they were doing being on a bullhorn right outside a classroom or something. But the place that they're asked to move to has to be a comparable space. So if they chose that space because of the traffic, the space that you move them to has to have a lot of traffic too. Those are all the things that have to be taken into consideration. And there's a need to distinguish between dissent and disruption. You know, I think it was Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes when he talked about the value of the First Amendment. It's not so much to protect that you feel the same. It's to protect that you may find really offensive, right? It's to provide that free marketplace of ideas. So when somebody disagrees with what's being said, that alone is not a reason to remove or prohibit the expression, all right? Disruption, however, disruption of a classroom, of somebody getting to where they need to go, those things I can call campus police and have somebody removed if they're doing that. But as I said, most of these individuals know their rights. They know the edge that they can go up to, okay? So on the back, I've got a little case study, a scenario. Preacher Bob.
Wait, it's not Preacher Barb.
Is there a Barb in the room? It's from the book, but it's very similar to some of the reports I've received. The language was kinder in the book. The language that students have reported or faculty or staff have reported that the preachers on the Oval at OSU have been using is far more sexual and far more offensive. All right. And there's been an uptick in that. I was talking with a friend of mine who's been at the university for 30 years, Louise Dowse. And we're talking now, when we cross the Oval, we don't hear it anymore. You've come to tune it out. But we have noticed in the last few years the language that's being used is just really, especially the language targeting the young women or perceived gay. I don't want to use the words, but those things seem to have upped the game. But even though we find them offensive, the fact that they're saying it does not mean they can be pulled off. And that's interesting, given obscenity is one of the exceptions. But again, the burden of proof of evidence is so high under that. So the case scenario is that Preacher Bob comes to the Oval or Mall on your campus for several weeks each fall and spring. Bob is well-versed in his rights regarding free speech. Surrounded by a sizable crowd of students, he blows his whistle at women passing by and states loudly, "Women with short hair and women who wear shorts are whores and are doomed to burn in hell." He also blows his whistle at those he determines to be gay, Jewish, or Muslim, with accompanying words about them being doomed to burn in hell. Is this free speech or harassment?
Want to say a little bit more?
No, I'll let Jan do my job.
Well, I would say it's harassment because it's against the dignity of the human person, and it's a defamation towards these individuals.
Anyone else?
Unfortunately, I think it's free speech because we know, for instance, the great example of that is Fred Phelps, and he does worse than any of this and does it blatantly, and he is one who knows his rights, you know, and I guess, yes, and I understand he even makes some money that way by suing people who try to take that right away, so he sets people up to, you know, get after him, but he seems to win, and unfortunately there are ways to deal with him, but I would say this was free speech.
My sense is harassment that is covered under free speech, and that's the reason why it happens, and it's both. I don't think it's either or, and the person who are projecting this know that very well and are not countered by those within their own religious tradition. And so part of the challenge we have is that if any dynamics need to happen in such a situation, it is best coming from the religious group that individual is coming from. That can be goes into what I would call intra-faith dialogue, which is even more difficult than intra-faith dialogue.
Okay.
Although it's obnoxious, I would say it's probably not harassment, because I think with harassment, the person who's offended also has to feel that in some way something's going to happen to them that's bad. You know, like sexual harassment in the workplace, it's harassing because it's somebody with power over you who could potentially get you fired or have an impact on your career, and some preacher standing in the Oval other than offend you, can't do anything to you to actually hurt your life other than be offensive. So my guess is this is more free speech than harassment.
I mean, I've personally kind of went through this a few times, and I would say it is harassment, because for someone to say you're going to burn in hell, you know, that it might be offensive, but it, like, hurts, too. Like, I thought of, like, the two or three times that this has happened to me, and, like, looking back, I did dwell on it for an unnecessary amount of time, I guess, so... I guess it would count as harassment in that sense, in an emotional way. So
I think that bringing it back to the fact that this is on a campus, so this is an educational environment, for me, what I started to think of it as is, you know, I think Valpreet makes an excellent point for this, is the fact that I feel it gets into the whole bullying aspect of it, how, you know, if we're talking about elementary kids or middle school kids or high school kids who are dealing with this sort of, you know, bullying through media or bullying through peers, how is that any different from a student walking across the Oval or walking from one class to another and hearing basically this, you know, what this preacher is saying targeted towards them? I mean, to me, I feel like if we parallel like that, I don't know how, if views are changed on that.
Well, it's very interesting to hear all your perspectives, because, of course, we're here because we think that language is wrong. But as wrong as it is, our laws would allow it. The speech would have to be so severe as to deny an individual the ability to benefit from educational programs and services, which is the function of a college campus. And that's what those people hide behind, right? Because it is unlikely that the speech meets this standard. Now, the creation of a hostile climate, those sorts of things, that's a whole other conversation. But for the words that were said, for to go into a prohibit or to remove what he said as stated in the case, we could not do that. All right. So let's go to the second question. One of the exceptions that you noted on the other side was fighting words. And now, I'm not a case law expert, but there's been a lot of cases that have gone up under First Amendment around what constitutes fighting words. And that's when I keep pushing you, I keep saying things, you might strike out at me first, right? Fighting words. So is Preacher Bob's rhetoric, considered hateful to some individuals and groups, considered fighting words?
It's related. Oh, yes, it's related to the first.
It all depends. I know that, you know, for those who have experienced it, it certainly cuts to your core. And yet I can't help but, when it says short hair and shorts, doomed to burn in hell, you know, the woman with a good retort might say, well, then it's a good thing that I'm dressed appropriately. You know, that type of a... you know, that diffuses, or it makes light of whatever Preacher Bob is saying. It in a way that just says, you know, I'm saying something just as ridiculous as what you're saying. But as far as fighting words, it depends on the individual that they would have to depend. I mean, I had an uncle one time. Somebody called him an SOB, and he says, "You don't talk about my mother like that." And he, you know, got into a fight. So it depends on how the individual determines it. That's to me, fighting words are very subjective. It depends on who you are, where you come from, what, you know, because some people, you could say a lot of things and it would not prompt them to retaliate physically, whereas others, it wouldn't take much.
Yeah, I would agree that when you say fighting words, it's an individual thing. Yeah, you might want to fight, but probably for the legal definition, probably not especially being you said that this was designated a public area where that could be done, so that there's an assumption there that people know when they're in that area that, that this is something that could be said, and therefore it's free game. I remember a number of years ago being in the very Orthodox section of Jerusalem, Jewish Orthodox, and seeing big signs in the neighborhood saying basically the same thing. Those of you women of Israel who wear shorts and things like that are doomed to hell, you know, and just big banners in the neighborhood, you know, from, so, you know, it just depends too on, I guess, your cultural perspective. But like you said, this is designated a free speech area.
Perhaps speaking from a psychological perspective as one myself, it seems to me that there could be an issue of mental instability, and that could lead to violent action. Now, granted, it's subjective, but depending on how it comes across and the intensity in which it is articulated, it would seem to me that it would be somewhat of a gray area that could go in question. Maybe it would lead to excessive litigation regarding something more than just free speech. And how do we do that? What do we say about Newtown and other areas like that where the physical and the psychological work together? And if he's bringing in something of the so-called spiritual aspects having to do with more than day-to-day living, that that could have an impact on the relationship again, which comes across very subjectively, and where do you make the line between the objective and the subjective? But if it leads to some type of behavior, if one could say Preacher Bob is doing this over and over and over again, and his voice and the intensity and even some of his mannerisms without going overboard into actual physical contact, I think it at least has some merit to be looked at more seriously.
There is definitely a subjective place in this. For example, if you're walking across the oval and I'm falling behind you yelling in your ear those words, I'm in your space. That could be a reason for somebody to be removed, right? But if I'm standing, even if I'm blowing my whistle at you and yelling at you, the argument is I could leave that space, you know? And so so the answer is no. To be considered fighting words, it would mean that the words tend to provoke an immediate breach of peace. Campus preachers are typically keenly aware of First Amendment laws and are careful not to engage individuals in this manner. I'm yelling at you from a distance. I'm not in your ear, right beside you. Although hate speech is a commonly used term, it has no legal definition and is not in and of itself a category of prohibited speech. Right? So the third question, if the preacher is disruptive to classes being held nearby, can he be moved? We talked about this a little earlier. Yeah, that's an easy one. Teaching is a legitimate function of the university.
Students are disruptive sometimes. I teach, I can't remove disruptive students.
In the class.
I want them
from
my class, but I can't kick them out. Unless it gets really, really
that's the tipping point issue. And the tipping point is subjective. Right? Yeah. And again, the alternative location.
Did you use that it was, as long as it belonged, you said the definition, I'm sorry, as long as it belonged the teaching?
If the preacher is disruptive to being classes? Because you're disrupting the mission of the institution. Yes.
Blowing a whistle.
Okay.
How much of blowing a whistle becomes disruptive, and then who makes that judgment call?
I would call OSUPD,
I would call OSUPD, our police department. The Chief Denton, who's the chief of OSUPD, is wonderful, and they have to do subjective calls all day long, right? They would come out. The problem is the students who surround the speakers and engage them. They're actively engaging, calling names, having conversations back and forth. That makes it far more difficult for a law enforcement official to determine, is this theater or are the students truly offended? Yeah. So if you've ever been on a campus in a warm spring day, mm-hmm. and there might be a group surrounding and seeming to have a good conversation or a back and forth. I don't know if I'd call it a conversation, a back and forth. Mm-hmm. And if you're the law enforcement person because a student walked by and was offended, what I'm seeing is students who are actively engaging. Yeah, not protesting, actively engaging. Right?
If somebody who walks across the oval here at Ohio State, our faculty club where we take, you know, when we have research collaborators and others come, you have to walk across the oval. So I've learned a lesson over the 23 years I've been at Ohio State, is when my research collaborators are with me in spring, I will avoid going through the oval. Because I don't want, I'm used to, in some ways, what you said,
tune it out.
But when I'm with others who are invitees on campus, it can't be tuned out. So my only option then is to take a different route behind the library, which is what I call the less scenic route on Ohio State campus, and be able to take them. So my guests who are here for a research project, they are with me. Don't get disrupted.
So the fourth question is, may the preacher be removed if the audience grows upset or even angry?
Yes. For the safety of the...
Yes, for the safety of the preacher, Bob. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm sorry I'm removing you because I fear that the group is growing to a level where something may erupt or your physical safety is in jeopardy.
What would be the tipping point that you would determine that they're in jeopardy? What level of anger?
Actually, not level of anger, but level of volume of voices, but also body language. If you start to see proximity being broached, in the case of men, usually anything related to pretty much silverback gorilla. Looking, I do the same thing, so believe me, I know what I'm talking about. Where they start to, you know, really bare their chest, start clenching a fist, jaws are getting tightened. It's going to happen anytime soon.
What's that? Start collecting and moving.
Yeah. Even jumping up and down. No, I'm serious. Guy, you know, they're getting ready. They're bobbing. That up and down movement, that's, you're getting pumped up, you're getting the adrenaline going, and it won't be long until something happens. Sounds like I hang around a lot of people that do this, doesn't it?
You live close to a zoo, do you? You live close to a zoo. Right?
Again, I think that's the rational way to think, but my understanding is the reason a lot of these people are here to begin with is to make you angry. That's their whole point of being there. So I don't see a point where they know what their right is. They want to make those people angry, and they probably don't want to leave if they were asked to. I mean, they have the right to stay there and have people be angry. And they have the right to be protected by law enforcement so they can do what they do. I mean, that comes out. I've dealt with Fred Phelps several times, and that's exactly how Phelps operates. You know, he wants them to be angry at them and to do something irrational so he can sue them.
It's almost the baiting, yes.
I just have a question. Why would... So I'm really confused as to why you would come onto a campus to incite hate. So that's my problem with all of this. I mean... It's like, why do you think it's important? Like, why would Preacher Bob deem it important to come on campus where he knows he's not gonna convert anyone, that's for sure. And like, so why would he come on campus in the first place?
Father Joe has a thought.
Not that I'm into the mind of evangelical Christian preachers, although I've met many. I think it's about, they believe they're planting seeds in people's minds and thought processes so that they could consider their morality or their life or whatever. And I have never personally, I've only been in Colorado now just about 3 years. I'm sorry, Ohio. Oh, my goodness. I did campus in Colorado. I did campus ministry for 7 years in Colorado. But And I never experienced it there either. I mean, walking on the quadrangle, in this case the oval, although a colleague of mine here at Ohio State, our lay associate for campus ministry, he has experienced some of this. And it's always around the springtime and summertime when people are sunbathing themselves and then people start haranguing them. But I think that's what's behind it. It's to plant things in people's minds because they're not considering their spiritual life. Of course, it's coming from a particular lens, but the big question is what can students do to not encourage this kind of behavior or to diffuse it? I don't know.
I think that's where the role of, like, faith leaders, which is actually why we're here, for faith leaders to kind of have those active discussions as to how do you really approach someone who's doing this. And I think what I would like as a student is to have someone who would, you know, we could talk about those insightful, hateful comments and discuss, okay, I'm shy, so how do I approach someone who's telling me I'm going to go to hell while, like, being in my person, like, how do I tell them as a person, as my own person, and, like, to have exercises and to have open conversations so you're kind of comfortable with the fact that, okay, someone is spewing hate at you, but I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to go into guerrilla mode, right? Okay. You know, so I would like that from faith leaders, is to have a venue to have that conversation, to have training in that sense, I guess. Even, like, simulations.
I think we're moving into the meatier part of the conversation. Thank you, Balpreet. I want to take us there, if that's okay, Rebecca. I just want to wrap up. Number four, the answer is no, unfortunately, right? There may be strong emotions in the mix, and again, that comes to the subjective. If police are there, they'll be observing the behavior. But the scenario is just the words, and people are angry, but they're not doing the bobbing. They're not. And even if there's strong emotions that are stirred in the audience, the person has the right to speak their mind. Yes.
But doesn't the university or any institution have an affirmative obligation to protect this person? So someone is, and going back to your comment, this person may, people may be pounding their chest and about to attack them, but I think the university has an affirmative action to protect free speech and that person's safety.
There is an expectation of protection. So, for example, when Westboro Baptist Church comes to campus, they choose a corner, so they're not exactly on the oval. They're on a public sidewalk. There's maybe six or eight. But they put out the word, and they ask for police protection because they know that will draw the media and that will draw the students. All right? So people ask for the protection for different reasons.
Well, say they'll be. I mean, that's life. They are entitled to it. No matter how hateful the speech, they are entitled
yes, they are.
To protection.
Yes, they are. It's just like when the Knights of the White Camellia come to downtown Columbus. That's a branch, that's a youth branch of the KKK. Columbus Police Force is out in force erecting fences, protecting them, because that's their right to protest, to do their rally, right? But the piece that I would want, and of course these students get it, but the piece that I would want the students that are surrounding or drawn to the corner when Westboro Baptist Church comes is for them to understand they're playing into their plan. They want the crowd. They want the yelling, right? Because that makes for good media, right? Yes.
Some of you may know this, but we dealt with that in Wyoming with the Matthew Shepard thing in the Westboro Baptist Church, and Fred Phelps were there. And really at the funeral, at his funeral, and their whole point was to be the center of attention at his funeral with all the hateful signs and everything else. And the way it was dealt with was wonderful. A bunch of people got together called the Guardian Angels, and they all got great big wings, angel wings, and they surrounded Phelps' group and raised the wings. Nobody could see him the entire time he was there. And that was their free speech to be able to do that, so it countered it very well. He can be dealt with.
Yeah. I do want to say about that, I think I would be curious to know if that was organized by students or community members. Because I think we have an ethical obligation not to ask students to do that. And I think feel very strongly about that. I think if students want to do it, that's fine. But I don't think we should be asking them to put themselves in that place. And I think that comes to what is the role of us who are employees of the institution or affiliated. The students may be a member of your congregation. You know what I mean? And that, to me, is the meatier part of the conversation today. What can we offer? I wanted to set it up for you all to understand why people may expect the university to take swift action, but we cannot because of the scope of First Amendment rights, right? But there are ways we can partner together to support the students, places where it's appropriate for the roles of those who are employees or affiliated with the university to take a leadership role. We can guide, we can encourage, but I truly feel we should not be asking students, right, to step into that place unless they choose, unless they ask, unless they express the desire to do that. I did put some resources down. Depending on your scope of your area, you might be working with a smaller campus. A smaller campus typically has a dean of students. And I would add, you would need to have a good relationship with whoever is the dean of students. That's the person who would be one of the first people called if something like this was going on. Or whether it's because somebody wants to press charges or they feel the safety of the students. But the dean of students would be an important piece. We have a bias response team at Ohio State. Not all campuses do. But if the campus that you're affiliated with does, you need to know who convenes that group. Interfaith councils, whether they're on campus or in the community. Student conduct, that's the student judicial affairs. So if it's student on student, you know, and it violates the student code of conduct, that person will be called up through that office.
Has there ever been cases where, like, they brought a minor onto the Oval? And like
some of them bring their families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How would you deal with that then?
Well, if the parents, they're there with the parents' permission. It's just like the picketing at the women's clinics.
Oh. Okay.
You know, there was a group from Florida that would come through the Midwest, and there were several clinics in Columbus, and I lived at the end of one of the streets, and I got caught at the stoplight, and they crowded around the car, put pictures up against the window. My kid was strapped in her car seat in the back seat. It was awful. But they were very young.
Mm-hmm.
But they're with their parents, Valpreet. And then I think I take my kid to peace rallies. It's indoctrination. It's not your idea of what you would want, but it's indoctrination just as I indoctrinate my kid. And that's where I have to kind of keep my mind constantly going back and forth.
So I just have another question. I think it was in North Carolina or somewhere in the East Coast. They have a supremacy group, student organization on campus. And, like, what if a student organization on campus decides they were going to, you know, have hate speech?
If Preacher Bob was a student.
Yeah, if Preacher Bob was a student, how would you go through that?
That student would do it in a public space and or do it in a dorm, which is not a public space.
Those are all considerations. But we have registered student orgs that discriminate membership if you're gay at Ohio State. So I think that those are dicey conversations, and sometimes your campus policy is trumped by state policy. Right? So I guess I'm not saying that there's easy answers. It's complex, and the scenarios and definitions that I've given are to invite a review of overlaying First Amendment rights before you take action. Right? It doesn't mean that there's a formula. Yeah, which I think that would be great. A plus B equals C, right? It would be nice if there was a formula, but there's a subjectivity in all of these, and that's why it's so important that the community and the university partner together in finding resolution, because the resolution will depend based on time, circumstances, the people involved or not involved, all of that. But there are other things on there. You may work with a campus that has an office for religious life, right?
So obviously they would take a leadership piece in this. And diversity and inclusion, multicultural affairs office, facilities staff. People sometimes don't think about them, but they're the ones that manage the oval, the buildings. It's great to have some friends on the facilities staff. And campus police, of course. And then the last is the reference for the book that I referenced earlier. But I did want to make sure we had time for the students because we're kind of going into the what ifs and desires section. So.
So I think regarding the oval, what Balpreet was saying before, one thing in like conversations I had with Rebecca that kind of led to me being here is dealing with dealing with campus preachers, especially as somebody who is a follower of Christ. You know, hearing people using teachings of Jesus to condemn others in a way that I'm not really sure if Jesus would approve of. Like, how do I as a Christian address like these, like this issue, hate speech on campus? How do we like go about it in a way that's not just feeding into the fire and just feeding into the argument, but actually in a constructive way that will help things get done? And also, I think what the point of what the preachers are trying to do is trying to broadcast what they believe are teachings, like from the Bible, but or whatever their religious tradition, I guess. But you know, what is a way that we can effectively like tell people about our faith that's not in the manner that they're doing? So I think one thing that I've thought might be helpful is for religious leaders, like campus ministry leaders, to, if this is a concern on a campus, to be giving us tools, giving us training of how to engage these like these kind of conversations. Because I think as students, we just, you know, we're still very young for the most part. Most of us don't have any kind of experience with any kind of like public forum with this, especially with this like degree of like rhetoric that they're using. So, just simply as myself, you know, as somebody who's like just 21, like I just don't feel like I have the experience or the skills to necessarily like engage somebody in a way that's constructive. Something I actually just thought of when I got here was, you know, I wonder if I just were to like invite them out for coffee or something and like ask them like why they're doing this, if it'd be something that would like actually be helpful, but I don't know, maybe I'll try that next time I see them. But I think just in a whole, like, you know, students that are in campus ministries and campus churches, things like that, I think if there is a space for, like, kind of a student ministry, you know, that might be something if the students are concerned about that they address, give them tools, you know, this is the way that you should have these kind of conversations, or this is the most loving thing you can do towards this person. And then the other kind of two major points I had were actually not really to the camp, to the oval setting, if that's okay. But one... more classroom space. And this is where I guess maybe the public and private, I think the classroom would still be considered a public setting to some degree. But I think for me, one problem I've always had also was in classroom settings, you know, where does the role of religion fit into classroom discussions? And I think just from my past experiences, that's also something that just like raising... raising like your points about like ways you might want to talk about your faith or defend your faith against like accusations that are brought up in the classroom. I know like between classes that I'm a double major in zoology and comparative studies, and between like classes on evolution and like teacher making comments about like certain people believe and then like this and this and they're all crazy kind of, and then on the other side comparative studies and having people kind of conflate systems of oppression with Christianity has always been something that I've been very kind of hurt by, but not really sure how to express that to the teacher or other members of my class where they might, they, I mean, they have valid experiences of dealing with Christians or the church and be feeling hurt, but that's thrown out there. And I just kind of like, I want to like kind of address that person. I have a couple of times like gone up after class to the person and talked to them, but just it's something that, you know, for me, it's just like, I want to, speak out on what my experience is with the church and with Jesus, but I just don't know how to do that because no one's ever talked to me about how, like, no one's prepared me for it. So I think that's the kind of thing of, like, maybe a campus ministry might be considering doing more on campus. And, yeah, the last thing I had kind of, I guess, was a little bit kind of farther off topic, but, like, one thing, like, as even though I am a follower of Jesus, I think that when I walk across the oval, sometimes I get mistaken as somebody who is not because of the color of my skin. So I think that's another thing that for his campus ministry leaders to be aware of is kind of resourcing students of color, especially like brown students who are followers of Jesus. Like, how can we care for like these students who may face issues or face discrimination that white Christians do not?
Okay, so I think that towards the end I may just reiterate what Andrew was saying, but I did kind of want to talk about, show our history as Better Together, and after Balpreet and I came back after the conference. So as we've been discussing already, clearly this is a very difficult issue to try to just solve. You know, there's no one solution to this. There's no, everybody has different experiences, like Andrew was saying, with students in different classrooms, et cetera. So I wanted to say how, I'm not sure if before I say this, being at the conference was an amazing experience. Again, like I said, seeing the community of people, seeing this whole interfaith movement that's a new movement started by Eboo Patel, and really seeing how, Balpreet and I weren't the only students who are realizing, what is needed in conversations and in dialogues, et cetera. But I was even more blown away by examples of different campuses who have actively been able to do something for these similar events on their campus. For example, Balpreet just reminded me that it was Stanford who was able to organize this whole interfaith response to who were they? Yeah, that's what I thought. It was the Westboro Baptist Church, and they had a festival going on while they were there, or something like that. It was like a huge response that was just amazing for me to hear, and then at the same time reflect and be like, why isn't OSU, campus, why isn't Columbus doing that as a response as well? I think that my conversation is going to be more so tailored to OSU. So I'm sorry if those of you who are not from we're not involved in the OSU community, but I'm sure anything can be reflected back to other campuses. But so that was a huge example that I think Balpreet and I came back, and our other friend who came with us, Madeline, was also very excited to start doing things on campus, to start doing things on for our Buckeyes, and create. I was like, oh, we're gonna have film showings, we're gonna have dialogue, we were very spirited and very encouraged after the conference, to then find out that kind of dwindled as the year went on, because it was very interesting for us to not, I think how what Andrew was saying, like, how do we communicate to students about how great it is to have interfaith dialogue, how great it is to really see that we're not that different. We still want the same things, exactly. We still want peace. We don't want, all these languages and words being said. And I wonder if it's, again, specifically as an example on OSU campus, if it's the fact that there is, preachers, and there is all of this hate speech going on in the Oval, that when we come up and we're like, enter, and then we say the word faith, that everybody shuts down. Everybody really just is like, no, that's okay, I'm not interested, it's because they think that it's preaching. They don't think that it's an open, safe space dialogue. So that was my, as we were going through all of this, that was my thought. I don't know if the this whole preaching hate has caused some sort of backlash in students to not want to attend our events that has anything to do with faith or religion in the title or in our, marketing or in our mission, anything to, because it's been really hard to do that, which then also gets back to, like I said, what Andrew was saying, and I'm sure Balpreet will say this as well, of what do we want from our interfaith leaders? And I think that it really comes down to, again, how Rebecca was saying, just really educating, training, equipping the student congregations with at least just the knowledge of how important this is. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. answers that they really need.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the whole thing.
For
so many unparent homes,
mm-hmm.
and the children just don't have, they just get to run about like they want to, and they
mm-hmm.
get to settle down and have lunch and breakfast and dinner with their family,
mm-hmm.
have families. Don't go to church. They don't make them go to church.
I have a question for the three of you. And I guess as we've been talking, my question has more to do with is your interest in how to engage and respond to those who are on the campus providing this hate speech? I mean, is your concern for their well-being as far as their changing their opinion, changing their understanding of who you are? Or is the concern, how do we help the student body who is affected by this come to realize that this is not representative of any of our faiths?
I think it's the third one. We kind of want people to realize that not all Christians prescribe to this belief. And my favorite thing to say is a belief in a singular story is very dangerous. And so if we can show students, like, not all Christians are hateful, there's not faith in general or religion is not just Preacher Bob, right? And to make them realize that, you know, even if we're not speaking about faith openly, there are people that hold their faith, like, dear to themselves. Right, and we should be aware of the diversity that is on campus. Like for me, I know, like, being on campus, it was a challenge at first because obviously I look different and obviously I'm not Christian, and so people were afraid to talk to me. But I didn't want them to be afraid to talk to me. Right, I wanted to make friends. I wanted to have real relationships, and in that sense, what interfaith going to the ILIs and, you know, meeting all these people, you kind of realize how diverse the entire student body is. And if you could somehow translate your experiences and your knowledge of diversity to other people, then you're just broadening their kind of experience on campus, right? And so, I mean, like, what I would like to kind of put in is like, we also have to realize not only Christian students are being affected by Preacher Bob, right? Like, I, being a sick woman, have also been affected. And that, I guess while there is a strong, like, Christian-affiliated, you know, backbone, like campus ministries, those are obviously Christian groups that are there to help Christian students. However, like, what about the sick students? You know, who do they go to when they're feeling bullied or when they're subjected to hate speech? Where do the Baha'i students go to? Where is their backbone? And so I feel like that is where interfaith comes in. So, like campus ministries, despite being Christian-affiliated, they have the tools to talk to me, right, and kind of share my, I guess, pain at being, like, told go to hell, you know. So, like, that's why I think interfaith is important, because you can transcend kind of religious boundaries while still, you know, being Christian, but you can have a conversation with almost anyone and still, you know, make them feel at home. You know, they might not have a physical home, a family, but we do want a sense of community within our university. And whether we get that from campus ministries or an interfaith organization, that is up to how we kind of make it out to be. So, does that make sense? I rambled.
Yeah, I think I definitely affirm everything that Valpreet said, but I think to answer your question, my answer would be yes. I care about all of them. Definitely, I think there's a level to which how, like, people using, at least as, you know, somebody who does follow Jesus, how people are using his teachings to affirm personal agendas that I think you know, if their point is to be out there planting seeds among people, they're planting something else. I remember the only time I've actually engaged with one of these people was because I saw my friend talking to him. I went up to my friend, I'm like, what are you doing? And then I got pulled in the conversation, and this person was trying to tell me that Jesus supports gun rights, and whatever your stance on gun rights are, I'm pretty sure Jesus never said anything about guns in the Bible. So he's like, this is in the Bible that Jesus said that we should have guns and whatever. I'm just kind of I don't. Yeah, so I mean, like, there's kind of like just weird things like to that level that I would like to address, because, you know, there's definitely misinformation everywhere around Jesus and his life and all these kind of things about the church. But I think as from a Christian conference and as Christian leaders, I'm like, that's the kind of thing that I'd be concerned about. But there's also a level with the student body, like the other experiences I've had. I've walked walking across the Oval with a Hindu friend, and both of us are like Indian, so. Like the experiences I had is, you know, they're just kind of yelling at both of us, even though, you know, I didn't actually tell him that I identify as a Christian, but, you know, if he had known that, would he have treated me differently? But that's for the welfare of the students too. And then the last point is I am kind of like definitely concerned with these people, just like as I'm concerned with anybody of like how they're living their life and what their relationship is with God. I would want that the person to enter into a full relationship with God eventually. I'm not really sure where they are right now, but I would just, like, from their hateful actions towards me, I just would want them to find the love that I know that I have found. So I guess, like, my answer would be, like, yes, I would want to see that happen, like, on all levels for them.
We have about 15 minutes left. And so I'm just wondering, Carmen, if you still had some comments you wanted to make, and then Balpreet, if you had some other comments too. And then I was wondering if you could just talk about where the leadership is with Better Together is at this point. And I guess, Balpreet, I'd just like you to share that incident. Because I think it's powerful in terms of what Interfaith Youth Corps training gave you as a skill. So, I don't know, you want to continue, Carmen?
Please go ahead, Balpreet.
I'm actually privileged to be in the room with Balpreet because for 2012, she was designated by Huffington Post as the Religion Person of the Year. In previous years, they have chosen the Pope and many other notable people, and I know this is humbling for her, but what she's going to share with you is will tell you why the Huffington Post chose her as a Religion Person of the Year for last year.
Thanks, Darcy. That is important. Okay, I wasn't going to go that far, but basically, I came back from a biology exam, and, you know, I typically, you know, don't think of myself as any different from any other Buckeye, right? I don't expect anyone to treat me differently. And so I found out that my picture was posted, standing in line, checking my email, like every other college student, waiting for a bagel, on Reddit, and which is a website on the internet. You share pictures and you, yeah. And people were commenting on it, and the person had titled the picture saying, "I'm not sure what to conclude from this," obviously because I was wearing a turban and I had facial hair, which I personally keep because it's a commitment to my faith. And, I mean, I read all the comments, and I think there were like 600 of them by the time I saw it. And, I mean, people were saying a lot of negative things. But, I mean, through the training I had received at IFYC and kind of coming in contact with so many different people, Muslim hijabi women, Buddhists, atheists, and they all had their own personal reasons and their own stories as to why they are so passionate about, you know, being an activist, being a part of the social justice movement. And it was there where I actually learned how to tell my own story and kind of be proud of the fact that I am different. And it kind of gave me the ability to put words to
my own beliefs. Because sometimes, like Andrew and everyone has said today, you don't know how to engage with people because sometimes you don't have the words to communicate. You know what you want to say in your head, but it's hard to translate the thought into an actual sentence, especially when it's a high emotional scene and, you know, you're getting angry. Rationality just goes out the window. And so I responded in like a very, polite way. And I was not upset, obviously. I was just kind of like, okay, picture found on internet, that's fine. So I guess people were deeply affected about regarding my response. They told me that's so wonderful that you could keep your peace, despite having people, you know, make fun of you and say so many hurtful things. And I guess if we can all just kind of attain those skills, if someone had done that to me a year beforehand, I would have probably cried. But it was through interacting with interfaith leaders and just being open to the fact that, you know, many people have different experiences, and being okay with that, and being okay with the diversity that we have on campus, that is what kind of led me to just accepting it as what it was. And I use it as a chance to not change people, but just to say, hey, here's what the real story is. I'm not expecting you to learn anything. I'm not expecting you to go out and convert. I'm not expecting you to become a better person, but this is just me. I have an obligation to tell my story because you guys are assuming, and I don't want you guys to assume anything else for other people. And that's why I firmly believe we need an interfaith presence. As well as a mind perspective on life. Because through that, you recognize the sheer diversity and how different people really are. But at the same time, you realize how similar we all can be as well. So, that's why, when you are faced with those circumstances where people are, you know, talking about your faith in the classroom or they're talking about it at the Oval and they're not representing your beliefs, you somehow have the ability to communicate in a constructive manner and to have that expectation that you're just telling your story. You're not going out there to change anyone. You're not going out there to, I guess, convert people, but or expecting them to learn anything. You're just there because in the noise that is hate, someone has to be singing the song of love. And so if you just have to sing it and people will hear. So cool.
So I have, so actually with what Bob Preet is saying, I think that so I guess this is my last comment that I just thought of now. I think that it is really important to really go out and go from, you know, a lot of us, you know, being Christian. You know, I'm actually a part of the Newman Center community, and as important as it is to, you know, sometimes we get involved in our own religion, in our own space, in our own same way of thinking, I think that it's really important to kind of also remember and push those, you know, push individuals to really try to see the importance of interfaith. I mean, you know, how can, you know, I think Balpreet's experience is something that, you know, that really helped her. You know, the sense of having that interfaith exposure really helped her with that situation. And it's great that we have, you know, this room filled, but I really would like to see so many more individuals be interested in this subject, since it is really something that a lot of us deal with day to day.
So I want to just ask the rest of us really listening, are there more thoughts, reflections you have about what we might do better
as people of faith with campuses around us or with young people in our midst?
I'll say it loud.
We need the mic.
It's going to be one line.
We need to encourage more students to be in more programs like that.
If I might ask you, what was the pivotal in the experience that you had? What would you attribute to that experience as being that catharsis that led to you having that peace within yourself?
I'm not sure if I. What are you asking?
Let me express what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is that in that experience, there was a depth inside of you that found the authentic person, and you were able to claim and name and love yourself. And in that, recognizing that the only person that we can change is ourselves, and we can't change other people, but through the witness of our own authenticity, we are able to give the gift of self to others so that they in turn can receive us as gift. And for me, and it's taken me many, many more years than you, so I applaud you for your youthful experience of recognizing this, that we all, no matter what religion, no matter what race, we all belong to the human race. And each and every human person possesses the same inherent dignity. We all owe that respect to one another, no matter who we are. And just to be able to dialogue, you know, like the preacher Bob, you know, we can walk by and just ignore him. Because a social worker once told me, you know, if you don't feed into them, then they don't have an audience, and they'll quickly shrivel up. But that, when you're in a crowd or a public forum like that, that's difficult to do because it would take everyone walking by and totally ignoring. Or if you, you know, want to maybe consider looking at that person and thinking, what's going on? There is a skill that we learned in training called nonviolent communication. And when I first heard about that, I learned it through CPE, through clinical pastoral education. And I'm thinking, why are we learning nonviolent communication in CPE? I'm going to go visit hospital patients who are very ill. And then I realized as I got into it that it wasn't about physical violence. It is about the violence that begins with our own hearts and the words that come forth from our hearts and how those wound and impact and affect one another. And it's a simple four-step process of communication. And it's Marshall Rosenberg, so you can Google it and find it. But it's just an awesome way of, first and foremost, you just observe the situation without, and this is the hardest piece, without interpretation. Observe what's happening. And then you look at, what am I feeling myself personally? But that is being able to articulate true feelings and not intellectual thoughts that we claim as feelings. And then be able to look at the other person and then think, I wonder what that person is feeling. What feelings? Do I feel anger? Do I see hurt? And then being able to say, what need is coming up inside of me? Well, I need to have the peace to walk across campus with my friends and not have them have these words come at them. But what need maybe does that person have? To be able to see it from the both perspective. And then what request might I have to offer or to ask of that person? Or what is that person really asking of me? And then to be able to engage in some type of dialogue that would lead that person to the authentic personhood that you found in yourself. I didn't mean to preach.
Is so much meaner today than it was when I was a child. But I was harassed at school, and when they made fun of my name and they made fun of my clothes, and I would just say, oh yes, you know, and I just go along like I didn't care. And I think that's what you have to do, not let it hurt you. And that's, they'll quit doing it because they know they can hurt you. They're going to continue. So you have to be real right to, you know, just make yourself, don't let it hurt you like you know, like it really does. But in our day, you know, we didn't have all this television and
radio and electric lights and computers and all this good stuff that people are so more smarter than we ever were. And a little bitty 5 years old can work a TV and a computer for you, less than that probably. And it's just a different world, and you just have to learn to love yourself and let no one hurt you and just ask God to take care of them for you.
I just have a question for the three of you. When I came to High Street 23 years ago, I was not very religious. This campus changed me. I have a sense as things have transformed. Could you talk about your personal stories in terms of when you came to Ohio State, you know, were you very religious? How this experience being at Ohio State or being coming to a campus has changed you? One way or the other.
In short, briefly. Short form, briefly.
I'm not sure if kind of like the campus climate so much changed me, but I would say that I began a relationship with Jesus in college. I think like my faith, although I was grew up in the church, I think very much for me it was a cultural institution of coming from an Indian Christian family, and I think in college I just encountered the person of Jesus for the first time. So I'd say for me like college definitely changed me, but I don't think it was necessarily anything to do with Ohio State's campus.
Personally, religiously, no change, just in the way of I've always been involved with Sunday school, so I think that kind of always kept me going back and kept me involved, so that, I mean, I continue doing. But I feel like what has changed is the fact that it's such a diverse campus, and again, like coming back from a very Catholic family from Mexico and everything, you know, that kind of is still in me. But the fact of stepping up and kind of representing my own faith, mm-hmm. And culture and tradition to the interfaith, that's what changed in me, not necessarily personally, religiously.
I get it. For me, surprisingly, I grew stronger in my faith just because, I was always searching for a community of sick people, you know, to talk about things, but I also found that in the interfaith community. I found that same sense of what it feels to hang out with my sick friends. That same feeling exists in hanging out with my interfaith friends. But also on campus, what it has brought me is just another sense of pride and like a comfort. I've gotten used to the stairs. I'm not afraid of them anymore, and it's just like it's just like you just accept that there's so many people on campus for me, and then but at the end of the day, I'm in my dorm room alone, and all I have is my faith. So for me, I kind of just hang on to that, I guess, more now.
I just want to offer, as you were three talking, I'm the director of religious and spiritual life at the University of Rochester, New York, and we do a fair amount of interfaith stuff. We had a big interfaith banquet just Saturday night, and I've worked in the community doing interfaith work, and we did a workshop recently for high school students, and we did a workshop on media and popular culture. And so the exercise we had the high school kids do when they first got in, because they all had their smartphones, is just go to Google, and each group was given a different – one had Christian, one had Jew, one had Sikh, one had Muslim, one had – Baha'i, one had, and you put in the Google search, like, Christians are, why are Christians, and you get, like, things that come up,
yes.
And then we had the kids all report back. The only religious group where the things that came up were mostly nice things were Buddhists, and the only worst thing for Buddhists was, why are Buddhists bald? But all the other religions, most of what came up was negative. And, you know, that really said a lot to the kids. Like, oh, my God, out there in the popular culture, the assumptions about religious people, and this goes to your comment about what you've experienced in the classroom, because a lot of our religious students complain about the same thing. There's an assumption that religious people of any kind are somehow narrow-minded, mean, judgmental, stupid. And it seems to me that the interfaith that young people like you who are dedicated to your own traditions but interested in building bridges need to get out there and celebrate who you are so that those stereotypes can get turned around.
We were just talking about this in the car where I made a comment where I said stereotypes often define reality more than reality defines reality. So we have to find a way to fight those stereotypes. Yeah, perception is the only reality.
Is that the last?
But the fact that you do this in high school, I think, was the bigger thing, because what I'm realizing now, I'm a Lutheran pastor, I worry more about the kids just even knowing the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, and the Lord's Prayer, and the definitions. And when people say, shouldn't they be learning about other faiths too? I'm like, I can barely get them to know about ours. but that also sets them up for being more aware. So thank you. You've helped me realize that there needs to be also an exposure and an understanding prior to going off to college, where it's sort of like they get thrown into the deep end of a variety of faith cultures, and being able to respect them as well.
So,
yes, Rebecca, you want to conclude?
I just had two thoughts that I wanted to share before we convene. One was, I was reminding, as we were talking about Phelps and Westboro Baptist Church, about a dynamic that occurred on our campus. And I know for me, I would ask our faith leaders to help lead in this conversation. The students heard loud and clear, organize an event away from their event. So they created the Love Bomb event, where students could table. LGBTQ student groups are out there. All the groups that supported as allies came out. They called it the Love Bomb. It was great. It was student-driven. They had a disco ball, the whole thing, right? But the students, when I asked, did you ask the faith groups? They didn't, because they assumed that they would not stand with them. And that, to me, goes to the heart of the work that we need to do. That is a assumption. It may be true for some. We have to be really honest about it. But it's not true for all. But they did not ask that category because they did not want to have to deal with being rejected once again. Right? So I just want to put that out there, something that happened recently on our campus that I felt keenly sad for both sides. And the other piece that I just wanted to share is that I think universities are hungry and are needing of your advice and feedback around these issues. There is still so much of a dynamic and a public institution of separation of church and state. That is probably one of the most common things we've gotten back as Better Together has tried to go out to seek those partnerships. People don't understand it's not about proselytizing. It's about better understanding, being better citizens of the world. And I think that that is one of the things that the IFYC really talks about, is we're all invested because we want our next generation to be deeply capable, thoughtful individuals, whatever their traditions and values. And to send them out into the world not having an understanding of interfaith is a true disservice. Right. So
thank you to Balpreet, Carmen, Andrew, Rebecca. Thank you. Thank you. Very, very much. Appreciate your time. It's good to reconnect with Carmen and Balpreet, and nice to meet you, Andrew. So thank you. You're welcome.